Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Nicole Tucker. In this episode, I am speaking with Dr. John Nakayama, a gynecologic oncologist for Allegheny Health Network, about updates in the endometrial cancer treatment landscape. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Nakayama. Can we begin with you discussing the most exciting change in the field in recent years?
I think with endometrial cancer, what we're really seeing a difference is the rise of immunotherapy, in particular checkpoint inhibitors. Previously, we really only had, you know, carboplatin, Adriamycin, maybe a little bit of bevacizumab. Immunotherapy has really changed what our options are, especially in the recurrent setting. And there are open clinical trials looking to bring it into the frontline setting.
Thank you. And since we're on the topic of exciting news in the field, can you tell me how the combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab has impacted treatment since it was granted accelerated approval earlier this year?
So, I mean, I think that's a great question. I feel like all we're talking about is immunotherapy, but that's what it is. So every person that comes into AHN, when we take out their tumor, we send it for MMR testing to see, you know, do you have any loss of expression of these markers? And, you know, not only is that important for screening for Lynch syndrome, but it's the first step to decide, are you a good candidate for immunotherapy or not? And you can, you know, look at tumor mutational burden, MSI, all that stuff that I mentioned before. But that is a small fraction of the population. You know, depending on the study that you look at, maybe around 30% of the people are going to be eligible for pembrolizumab alone. What's different about KEYNOTE-775 is that these people are the people that aren't MSI high or MMR deficient. So that is a larger fraction of the population. And the surprising thing was how high their response rates were, and that they had such a high fraction of people with, you know, like the harder to treat diseases, the harder to treat histologies like serous cancers.
Results from the KEYNOTE-775 study, which led to the approval of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, were recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. What are your thoughts on the study results?
So, I mean, I think it's a very interesting trial. I think that, you know, it gives options to that group of people that weren't able to get pembrolizumab alone, right? It gives all those people an option with a very decent response rate. You know, you have to be cognizant of the kind of person that you're putting on, because, you know, this combination does come with some toxicity. So understanding what those toxicities are, how to manage them, and how to dose interrupt or dose reduce is critical to having success. Because if you don't set up the patient for success, like talking with their primary care doctor to make sure that their hypertension is well controlled, telling them that they may need to have their thyroid replaced, you know, in terms of like Synthroid or something like that, having all those processes in place is going to make them staying on the drug combination much more likely.
Thank you. And what are the implications of these combined study results?
Well, I mean, I think the next thing would be, this is recurrence, right? So in this study, they looked at, okay, these people that did not qualify for Pembro, this is how well they did in recurrence. Well, what if they tried it in an earlier setting? Is there activity there? You know, I kind of alluded to previously, like there are multiple trials open right now that are looking at the combination of carboplatin, Taxol backbone, and then adding in some sort of checkpoint inhibitor, either with the carboplatin and Taxol or as a maintenance setting. Is it possible that it's sort of like an analogous situation, like people that have, you know, a predilection for going with immunotherapy, well, maybe they should go with Pembro. Is there a role for analogous combination in a earlier setting?
Moving along in the treatment landscape, what role does bevacizumab continue to play in endometrial cancer?
Bevacizumab in my practice, primarily is used in the recurrent setting. Its response rate is similar to what we see in with other second line agents. It's got pushed back a little bit with the introduction of immunotherapy. There have been some small phase twos that have looked at it with in combination with other drugs, but in general, I reserve it for recurrent disease.
And what research supports your choice of when to use bevacizumab in your patients with endometrial cancer?
The data of bevacizumab in endometrial cancer is relatively limited. There's some small phase two data that supports its use in a recurrent setting.
What novel therapies are you excited to see clinical trial results for?
So I think everybody was excited about the possibility of the SIENDO trial. In that one, they looked at selinexor. Unfortunately, it didn't meet its primary endpoint, but they did show that in the P53 population that there was better outcomes. So I'm very excited to see how they move forward with that. I think that when we think immunotherapy right now, we're talking a lot about checkpoint inhibition, which when I talk to my patients about checkpoint inhibition, I'm like, well, it's kind of like that old movie, Spinal Tap, where they go to the amp and they turn up the amp to 11 instead of 10. It turns your immune system up, but that's just kind of like a gross way to just tell your immune system to attack. What I think is more interesting right now is now they're looking at, well, let's take some of your tumor. Let's build up those tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and give them back to you. Are there any vaccine options? Maybe not from a treatment standpoint. I think circulating tumor DNA is really interesting. Maybe we can use that as a method to detect recurrence earlier, or maybe even see if some of our trials might be better targeted, or our treatments might be better targeted in a way that's non-invasive.
Thank you. What improvements are still necessary in endometrial cancer treatment?
Well, we're never happy, right? I mean, every time you make an advancement, the next question is, how do you do even better, right? So to talk about what we are improving on right now is, like we just mentioned, checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy. So how can we improve on that? Well, we need to target the patients better. Yes, we're looking at MMR, MSI, tumor mutational burden, name your test of choice. But we know that a lot of those people, even though we think they're more likely to respond in that subgroup, we're not having the greatest response rates. Figuring out a way to determine who are the people that are really going to benefit from checkpoint inhibition is critically important. The other thing is, one of the big promises of immunotherapy is their long duration of response in some individuals. And if we could figure out who those super responders are going to be, that would be a huge advancement for endometrial cancer.
Lastly, Dr. Nakayama, what key advice can you give to your peers on how to approach endometrial cancer treatment today?
As we all know, it's really important to make sure that you have the appropriate testing done on your patient's tumors, making sure that you have some sort of testing that's been done to look to see if they are at risk for Lynch syndrome, to see if they might be a candidate for immunotherapy. And here at AHN, we're even starting to notice that they're starting to report out P53 on a lot of our endometrial cancers, which could be useful if selinexor or something like that becomes FDA approved in the future. We haven't really talked about it, but in the subset of people with serous uterine cancer, we're also making sure that people are screened and treated with Herceptin if that is appropriate for them.